Port-au-Prince. I play that with you for you with special reference to the fact that it is Mardi Gras this week. Carnivals are happening all over the Catholic world, or the formerly Catholic world, and that, in light of the fact that there has recently been an earthquake there, might lift the spirits slightly. That's how they bring in
Port-au-Prince.
Well, not so much. The thing is, there's all of these populations in and around the Caribbean are surprisingly resilient. And you will be amazed in 18 months' time how far they have bounced back from what has essentially been a virtual Armageddon for them. You know, it's not something they'll ever forget. But by the same token, there was an earthquake in northern Pakistan not that long ago. There was an earthquake in Azerbaijan not that long ago, which it fades from memory quite easily.
I went to Armenia after the earthquake when I was working for CAFOD, and that was shocking because it was 5 years after the earthquake and people were still living in the rubble of their buildings, in shelters.
Well, it's almost the same, I gather, because it's probably 3 years now since that earthquake in northern Pakistan. And a lot of those people still aren't housed, and obviously the international aid contingency disappear pretty quickly after, you know, the glamour shots have been taken, you know, the dragging children from
the Haiti has almost disappeared from the news, hasn't it?
It's almost entirely, yeah. But then again, unfortunately, the news moves on.
Yeah.
What does dismay me this week is the fact that it seems liar-in-chief Alistair what's-his-chops, Campbell, has managed to work his way back into the brown-eyed government and is now sticking him in front of Piers Morgan and drawing tears. I can't get over how spectacularly callous it is. Yes. Or am I alone in this?
No, they're a bunch of swine, really, let's face it. I mean, I'm not really allowed to say things like that, but I mean, there's something very unpleasant about
it's insidious.
The manipulation of people's emotions, isn't it?
I'm dazzled at how hubristic it is. They think people are going to believe it, that they're going to buy into this, all of this sort of thing.
Well, the trouble is, of course, that people want to believe it.
People want a quiet life, don't they?
I don't know. I think just this cult of personality. Because, in fairness, up until 10 days ago, for all of his shortcomings, Gordon Brown was a professional politician.
Yes,
and, you know, there was not a lot of him as an individual or as a celebrity going on behind. And I quite admired him for that. Yeah. He was thrown into a very difficult job at a very difficult time. Obviously, the job was made more difficult by his previous posting within the government. Mm. But it wasn't a flim-flam, and it wasn't all about him, the man, and who he was pressing the flesh with, like it had been with Blair for an awfully long time.
Mm. Anyway, I'm very glad we've got you pinned down here, Billy, because I'd like to just... One of the stories we didn't talk about this week in the first hour was the rather fragile state of the Greek economy and whether it's actually a good idea to be part of the Euro Club, because obviously the Republic, Irish Republic is. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think the Irish giving up what used to be called the punt, didn't it, has been a benefit to Southern Ireland?
On balance, I would say not, frankly, because at the time of entry into the ERM, as it was at the time, I think, or...
Well, it was a two-stage thing, wasn't it?
You
had to get into the ERM, and then you got all these wonderful new banknotes.
Before the ERM.
Well, strangely, because I was living here at the time, before the Irish punt disappeared... because it was just in the very early stages of the Celtic Tiger, the Irish punt had become very strong against sterling, which had always been sterling and dollar were the two that we were always measured against. Not so much the peseta or the drachma or the Deutschmark or the franc, but our two main trading allies were Britain and the States. Ireland had to devalue the punt twice to get back within the plus or minus 2.5% barrier set by Helmut Kohl, it was at the time, because he was the German Chancellor and Germany was really the main powerhouse behind the instigation of euro policy. What happened then, the minute Ireland entered the euro, everything became 40% more expensive. And I mean everything. I used to have, a man of simple taste, so I had a Mars bar test. In the UK, you can still buy a Mars bar for approximately 30p. You may have to shop around for it. If you buy one in a corner shop, you're paying about 38p. If you buy one at a motorway services, you're paying anything up to 52p. In Ireland these
60,
days.
Even 60, 70p in really? Some of the more expensive places, yeah.
Cool, this serves me right for not shopping in those posh places. In Ireland, a friend of mine, a good friend of mine, runs a shop. He runs a number of shops. He puts out Mars bars for 95 cent. And if you look at which way are, the punt is trading against... sterling at the moment, not the pound, euro on sterling at the moment, and this is hitting everybody in the pocket, bearing in mind there's a Euro Millions lottery tonight of 113 million jackpot. For those of you who do the lottery from time to time, you will notice you no longer get your Euro Millions ticket for £1.50 like you used to. It's now £2.
Don't do the lottery, folks.
Don't. It's yeah. Well, you know, you can do the
everything's
lottery.
Rigged against you.
The truth of it is, I'd sooner do the lottery than pay tax at the moment, because at least you have a chance of winning with the lottery.
Do you?
Well, you certainly don't have a chance paying taxes, do you? That said, Charlotte Leslie knocked on my front door the other day, which was quite a surprise. She's Bristol North West's... she's going for Conservative candidacy. And in fairness to her, she came across as quite genuine and was the first and most amenable person to knock on the door and try and press the flesh.
Martin, let's have your take on the Greek business this week, because we had big demonstrations. We had big demonstrations, didn't we, in Greece? And they see themselves, a lot of the workers and the unions in Greece, see themselves as on the front line. What happens in Greece is going to be what happens in other countries, including Ireland, that are part of the Eurozone and possibly in the UK too, with these massive slashing cuts in public services.
They're calling these southern European countries the pigs, aren't they? Portugal, Ireland and Italy, Greece and Spain, the pigs.
But, I mean, we also have a situation, quite serious problems in Birmingham this week as well, with massive amounts of employees, public sector employees being sacked in Birmingham.
This is going to happen all over the world. The state governments in the United States are all bankrupt, so they're talking about disbanding the fire brigade in California and sacking all the teachers. I think it's an interesting contrast between what the Irish policy of saying we're going to bite the bullet and reduce our deficit, and the Greeks just saying no, we're not going to bite the bullet and we're not going to reduce our deficit. I think Ireland can't take an independent policy on its own, but I think there's an element of masochism in the existing policy. What you do, in my view, is you say you're going to reduce the deficit, but then don't do it. You cheat. Mm. And that's what the Greeks are going to do.
It's an option, but this goes back quite a long time, to really even before the subprime toxicity raised its ugly head. People in Germany... were actively going back into the bank if their banknotes, because Germans really like high denomination banknotes. That's the reason there is such a thing as a 500 euro note.
They did in the 1930s, didn't
exactly.
they?
Exactly. But they were going to the cash point, and then if the notes they were being the euro notes being distributed to them were minted by one of the, as you called, the Mediterranean central banks, who are also printing money, they would take them back in and say, I would like my German banknotes, please. They wanted their euro notes minted by the German banks, because they kind of had a suspicion it was never really going to work.
Well, the problem is that you've got one policy. I mean, you see, Ireland and Greece had a much lower interest rate than they would have had if they'd had an independent currency, because they're in the euro. And the reason you've got a low interest rate is because the Germans were absorbing East Germany. So they needed low interest rates in order to cushion their economy. So the Germans basically dictated policy and said, well, we need low interest rates so that we can absorb East Germany. But the price paid for that is that the policy is absolutely out of line. It's the peripheral countries, which are Ireland, Spain, Greece, Portugal, they've had an unsustainable boom and bust because the one size just doesn't fit all.
So why is it, Martin, that this is all happening in Greece and it hasn't happened somewhere like Ireland before it happened in Greece?
Well, it's happening simultaneously. I mean, we haven't mentioned Eastern Europe now, but Ukraine's in free fall. Lithuania, I was reading about the other day, they've lost 20% of their GDP this year.
And what we've seen is that the Eurozone is not immune to this.
Well, nowhere's immune to this. You know, I mean,
are we not immune to it because we have kept our own currency?
What's interesting about Mr. Brown is that he was put under a lot of pressure to go into the euro, and the Liberal Democrats, for example, were pushing to go into the euro. Blair was saying, why can't we go into the euro? And Brown in his curmudgeonly way, said, no, we're not doing it. And in actual fact, you see, that gives us room for manoeuvre now. We've got independent policy. If we'd been in the euro, we'd have had even lower interest rates than we've had, and the bubble would have, and the boom would have been bigger, and the bust would have been bigger. You know, the British economy doesn't actually function in the same way as other European economies, so having a separate currency and having our own pound has actually given us some, you know, I hate to disagree with the Tories about this, but it's actually, it does give us some room for manoeuvre.
So, Billy, final word on this is all this, these big public demonstrations and all this kind of stuff going to be happening in Ireland soon?
Well, we have had some. There's talk of public service cuts.
A national strike?
We won't go as far as a national strike because inherently Irish people are very, very lazy. We don't have the climate for prolonged.
I think he's allowed to say that, is he?
Well, the thing is, it's absolutely true. If you look at any of the most successful strikes in history, they have always taken place during the summer or in clement weather conditions.
Oh, what about the transport strike of 1913 in Dublin? They didn't win, did they?
Well, in fairness to the Irish strikers at the time, they were subjects of a Westminster government, unlike nowadays. I think a lot of what happened, and all of the countries you mention, if we look at it historically, the working classes had always lived a very hand-to-mouth existence. Whereas in the slightly more developed and slightly more urbane economies in Northern Europe, people for probably 200 years at least had learned the lesson of saving a little bit and putting a little aside for the rainy day. And Germany and France certainly absorbed an awful lot of the Eurozone issues by having a lot of savings, and not like Ireland and Greece and Spain, when you went in, got your 120% mortgage with very little put down, and you went crazy and built apartments all over the Costa Blanca, ruined most of the Dodecanese islands and all of this sort of stuff, and now it's coming back to bite them because people just aren't going on holidays. The one positive to come out of this is that certainly last year and again this year, I think we're going to see an awful lot more Eurozone travellers coming into the UK to holiday, which can only work to Britain's advantage.
Okay, Billy, thanks. Now, 2 weeks ago, US President Barack Obama delivered his State of the Union address to Congress. Now, that speech contrasted with the alternative black State of the Union address delivered by entertainer and civil rights activist Harry Belafonte. Now, before we have a look at that particular story, Billy, you've got one more little thing you wanted to talk about, yes. The lamentable tragedy.
One final thing, it's the lamentable tragedy that changed Bristol forever. I know that Martin went to see this last night. It's a Wonder Club production, and it's a site-specific piece of theatre charting the history and the decline of the St. James Fair at Stokes Croft in, I think, 1836 or so. It had been a fair that had run for 800 years and really put Bristol on the international trading map for a while.
Yeah, I did go and see it last night, and it is a site-specific piece of theatre. If you go to the show, it's in Stokes Croft. I can't remember what
time is it on and everything, Billy. Can you tell us?
Well, I tried to get a ticket. You see, I was looking forward to seeing Martin this evening because he's been. I was intending to go and speak to the creative director myself this evening. Maybe Martin can tell us
where it is since he went last night.
Yes, he did. It's on at 8 p.m. anyway, and it will cost you £10 and £6 for a concessionary price. Tickets are available from the Tobacco Factory box office. Not tonight,
and from the canteen as well. There's a bar on Stokes Croft, you can get them in there.
So where does it actually take place, it's
in Stokes Croft. It's in what used to be a shop, I think. Mm-hmm. The audience are part of the play, yeah, so it's set in a fair, and you wander around to the various stalls in the fair, and you know, it's a very interactive piece of theatre, and it's good fun.
Oh, it's 15 to 19 Stokes Croft, and it starts at 8 p.m.
Did you learn anything, Martin?
No, it was a good night out. I mean, there's a big cast, and they're all having a great time. And I think
so. Is it like lots of different plays all going on at once, and you go from one to the next, or what?
It's quite cleverly done. I mean, you have to go and experience it.
Oh, that's no good. Come on, what a dreadful reviewer you are, Martin. You have to go along and see it for yourself. We want to know what it's like.
But it's a fun night out, and obviously the cast are enjoying. I know some of the people in the cast, and they're obviously enjoying themselves.
So it's not just the one performance in the one place. There's various performances going on.
You have to wander around. It's a whole experience. It's not just like going to the theatre and sitting in a seat.
Lovely.
Were the participatory audience dressed to the
orchestra? No. I mean, obviously the actors are all dressed in period costume.
Is it a bit of a Bristol history lesson too?
Yes, it is. It is. Yeah. Yes, I mean, all I can say, I enjoyed myself, and I would recommend people to go along there. I mean, it's all part of regenerating Stokes Croft as well, turning it into a bit of a, you know, what were empty shops and offices being used to do something cultural, you know, that's a good thing, surely.
Okay, and there is a website here. It's www.signflu.blogspot.com. Now, back to the State of the Union Address, which Barack Obama, US President, made a couple of weeks ago. But his speech contrasted with an alternative black State of the Union Address delivered by entertainer and civil rights activist Harry Belafonte. Back in 2006, Harry delivered a damning address where he said that the energy and attention of millions of black Americans was being misdirected. He believes that rather than Islamic countries, Americans' common enemies are much closer to home.
Let's go after the common enemy, which is capitalism in America in the hands of imperial tyrants. I said George W. Bush is a terrorist. I did not say that to be a name caller. I did not say that to step out and quote unquote disrespect the office of the presidency. I said that because I see that we have not taken charge of how we define our subjugation. We are living in terrorism as black people in America, yeah. And it has been that way since the dawn of slavery. If we are as oppressed as we are, if we are having the experiences we have in Katrina, if we're having the experiences we're having with our youth, with over 2 million in the prisons of America, the largest prison population in the world, if we're having problems with health care, if we're having problems with schools, if we're having problems with finding our own inner souls and dignity to live out a life that is honorable, what is it that has put us in this position? We didn't volunteer for it. And those who have put us here and have chosen to keep us here are people who deal in terror. And I think we need to not listen to how they see terror. We have to talk about how we see terror and broaden the definition.
Yeah, absolutely.
Murdering of Dr. King was an act of terror. The murdering of Malcolm X was an act of terror. The murdering of Medgar Evers was an act of terror. The murdering of Emmett Till was an act of terror. Sending young men and young women, sons and daughters from America, to murder people in other nations was an act of terror. You have medicine that can heal the sick and comfort the dying and abstain from giving it generously is an act of terror. To keep our young men and women unemployed and buried in ignorance is an act of terror. So I say, let us redefine terrorism. It is not just Bin Laden sitting in Afghanistan. It is in fact he who did what they say he did. It is how we, as African Americans, as people of color, as people who are ground under, it is how we choose to name the game. It is how we choose to create the definitions about our experience that must be recognized and honored. And the only way that can be done is for us to be the ones who take charge of these facts.
Yes, absolutely.
No oppressor has ever given freedom. Those who are oppressed have been required to take.
Well, that's Harry Belafonte there speaking in 2006, and it contrasts very strongly with Barack Obama's State of the Union address a couple of weeks ago. Martin, do you think this is an important issue, this, the idea of the war on terror and terrorism and how we define it?
Well, it's obviously important because it's been rammed down our throats ever since September the 11th, 2001. Although, of course, the government of the US now is not talking about the war on terror anymore. They seem to have rowed back from using that rhetoric. But obviously, I mean, our whole reality is being saturated with propaganda about it, isn't it?
Well, what he's doing there, really, is saying that many of the policies, for example, the incarceration of millions of black people in the United States, is a form of terrorism in itself. Do you think he's justified in saying that?
Well, it's political rhetoric, isn't it? I mean, what is terrorism? Well, it depends, you know, doing nasty things to people, well, that's terrorism, whether you drop a bomb from 30,000 feet or whether you blow yourself up in a bus.
But he's right. I mean, the US does incarcerate more people per head of population
absolutely
than almost anywhere else on Earth.
It's a very, very unequal and unfair society. And poor people get a very raw deal in the United States of America.
But, I mean, he's talking there about the assassination of Martin Luther King, for example, as an act of terror.
Yeah. Yes, and probably not carried out by the civil suit pursued by Martin Luther King's family uncovered that the state was involved in that assassination. So what we've got in the United States is a semi-democracy in which many elections are stolen and ballot boxes are stuffed and electronic voting is rigged. And then when you do get somebody that's halfway decent, they get assassinated. And these are the people leading the world.
Well, supposedly. Anyway, this week as well, we had in the Daily Mail and other papers release of some incredible pictures from the September the 11th attacks. I'm sure, you know, many people listening will have seen those and been quite shocked by the graphic detail that there is, and certainly all from a new angle, from a police helicopter. Do you think that these photographs shed any new light? And should we just sort of move on from September the 11th?
Well, we can't, can we? Because it's absolutely central to the political discourse that we've been plunged into. I hope most of your listeners are aware that there weren't just twin towers crashed on September the 11th. A third tower, WTC-7, collapsed at 5:30 in the afternoon, and exactly the same as the other two towers. And whatever explanation was given for the collapse of the other two towers, planes crashing into them and so on, although it looked like a demolition job, the third tower collapsed in exactly the same way with no plane crashing into it. And Stephen Jones, who's a physicist from what used to be Brigham Young University in Utah, he and others have uncovered the fact that nanothermite was found in the rubble of the Twin Towers. And nanothermite is a very, very high quality explosive. Who's got nanothermite? Well, only the Pentagon.
Well, this business of the collapse of Building 7 that afternoon is something that very few people have looked into in detail, but it does seem that there's something very strange going on there, because buildings don't just collapse without planes crashing into them or anything.
The architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth had a meeting in San Francisco this week. They've got 1,000 architects and engineers have now signed up to say, we don't believe you about this story about how these towers collapsed. And basically, when I was in Colombia 4 years ago, I was talking to social movement leaders there, and we were saying, well, we suspect that the Americans may have done this themselves, and they said, well, it's obvious to us.
Well, it's a bit worrying.
Out there in the real world, in the Middle East and Latin America, everybody knows. I've mentioned this before, General Leonid Ivashov, who was the commander of the Russian armed forces on September the 11th, people should just put in a search engine and find what he's got to say. He's saying, as far as we're concerned, this was an inside job by the US security forces.
Well, this is a little bit worrying, isn't it, if the entire basis of this war on terror, whether or not this is a rhetoric which is being used by Barack Obama, he's certainly pouring more troops into Afghanistan.
Barack Obama has said that we cannot question what happened on 9/11. And I think that just says everything about his lack of delivery for people. I mean, basically, sooner or later, it is going to come out that the US security forces carried out this attack. Francesco Cossiga, who used to be the former president of Italy, was interviewed in Corriere della Sera, which is a mainstream newspaper in Italy, and he said it's well known in intelligence circles that 9/11 was carried out by the US military with Israeli support. Now, that's well known around the planet. All the people in Africa and Middle East and so on, they all know that this was carried out by the US itself. But in the bubble we live in, with the kind of media we have, people still don't actually know what happened on that day. But out there in the real world, in Afghanistan, we had some Afghans come to speak in Bristol last year, and I said, you do realise that the Americans carried out the attack themselves? I said, we know. Of course we know. Everybody in Afghanistan.
Well, weren't you putting words into their mouth then?
No. I said, did you know about this? And they said, yes, we did. Of course, out there in the real world, where the Taliban is gearing up for another night's bombing their guys will be just getting ready to go out and do some plant some bombs and shoot some people. They know. They know that the whole thing's a fraud.
Well, they certainly believe it. And one of the problems is when people like Barack Obama say we can't question this. I think that's rather silly of him. And one person who has been questioning it is a musician from Brighton called Martin Noakes. Martin has written a song which has been around about on the internet for a year or so now called 9/11 Building 7. And unbelievably, he gets many of the questions that there are about the September the 11th attacks on which this whole war on terror is founded in song.
Like the towers, it just fell. The fire's not enough, no way hot enough to bring it down. The project for the new American century was added to a year before that day. It states in order to proceed, a modern
Martin Oakes song 9/11 Building 7 there, raising some of the questions that we were discussing before, and about some of the questions and facts to do with the September 11th attacks on which all this war on terror is based. Collapse is a feature film released in the United States which features ex-Los Angeles drug squad policeman Michael Rupert. He believes that the growth in world population over the last 100 years or so is because of oil, and that if we start to run out of oil, the world's population will fall drastically. Control of oil, he says, is also at the heart of this so-called war on terror. So let's have a little listen now to an extract from the film Collapse by Mike Rupert. First of all, peak oil, war for oil, and Dick Cheney's secrets.
You will recall that when the Bush administration took office in January 2001, a National Energy Policy Development Group, the NEPDG, was formed and placed under the exclusive private absolute control of Vice President Dick Cheney. Its records were kept a secret, its minutes were kept a secret. 7 pages were released as a result of 2 lawsuits. And it clearly shows that that task force was looking, saying, how much oil is there? Where is it? Who owns it? They knew that this was coming for a long time. It's been known that this event, this collapse, this crash was coming.
Who they were, we can't even get information as to who was involved.
That's a little extract there from this film, Collapse, Martin. Do you go along with this theory that actually a lot of this is about peak oil and about the fact that we're now facing a situation with quite drastic reductions in the supply of oil?
Well, I'm not necessarily convinced that peak oil is the problem that Mike thinks it is. War for oil is definitely going on. I mean, it's about oil, and it's not just about oil, it's about other important minerals and resources as well. But oil is a very key resource, and a lot of the fighting is about controlling it.
Well, one of Mike's sort of premises as part of this film is that the world's population really started to go up at a much, much faster rate after the introduction of oil, because this is being used for agriculture.
Our civilization is oil-dependent. There's no doubt about that. And we've not taken many steps to make ourselves less dependent. And, of course, fighting over resources is going on as we speak. You know, it's not a very happy prospect, is it?
Does it surprise you that Dick Cheney was sitting down and saying, well, we really need to do surveys of various parts of the world and find out exactly where all the oil is?
Doesn't surprise me in the slightest. I mean, that's what imperial powers have always done. They see what people have got and they make sure they go and get it off them. I mean, that's what Britain used to do when we were top nation, and that's what the Americans are doing now.
Okay, do you think there's any sort of difference in the character with the way the Americans are doing it and the British Empire did hundreds of years ago?
I think imperialism is unacceptable, whoever does it. I think we've got a 19th century mindset. The Americans, the US elites, are playing the same kind of games as they played in the 19th century. It's like the world domination game. We've got to get out of this. We're actually a tiny planet in the middle of nowhere, and we've actually got to cooperate together as a species and stop fighting each other.
Okay, let's have another listen to another extract from the film Collapse, Mike Rupert's film, which is out in alternative cinemas in the US, which may be over here at some point in the next year or so. And this is to do with 9/11 and the plans for the Iraq War.
11 days after 9/11, when there was no clear evidence that Saddam Hussein had anything to do with 9/11, of course he didn't, that the plans were started to invade Iraq, of course. That was the objective. Get control of that oil. We have no intention of leaving Iraq. We're never going to leave Iraq. Going back to 2004, we started building the largest, most permanent military bases, 3 of them, in the world, plus the largest embassy compound that's ever been built. We built an embassy compound in Baghdad that's bigger than Vatican City. That's not a temporary deal. Nobody's going to take that oil, but we are sitting on it. But there is not enough oil in Iraq to change anything. Iraq probably has around 90 billion barrels of recoverable oil. That sounds like a lot of oil. But when you consider that in 2008 the world was consuming 85 million barrels a day, that means a billion barrels of oil only lasts for about 11 and a half days, so that ain't that much.
The first of the good things in the program for Iraq, thanks to oil.
OK, Okay, again, that was a clip from this recent US film release, Collapse, by Mike Rupert. So what are your thoughts there, Martin? He's making it pretty clear there that the Americans are never going to leave Iraq, and I don't think we were told that, were we, when we were voting for the war?
No, I mean, the US have got bases all over the world now, so 100-and-something bases they've got all over the world. They've got them in Afghanistan, they've got them in Iraq. You know, from a Russian or Chinese point of view, the Americans are being extremely provocative, and this can lead to very serious errors of judgment. For example, we could, before an election in this country, we could be thrust into a war with Iran by the Israelis, by the Americans, by just events getting out of hand, and I think people should be really, really worried about that.
Okay, well, the final clip from Collapse is actually all to do with political parties and anachronisms of modern political parties, saying that actually the many of them are just in the past. And Mike Rupert's little message for us all is, we've got to grow up or die.
Every aspect of human existence is on the table. As far as political parties go, they're all anachronisms. They're all products of centuries gone by. The human race now is only going to be concerned not with an ideology, but what allows them to survive. Capitalism, socialism, and communism are all terms that need to be tossed in the trash can immediately, because all of them were created on the assumption of infinite resources. Not one of those ideologies that are now dead dinosaurs, archaic fossils, and no longer relevant to our way of life, not one of them recognizes that there must be a balance between growth and the resources and the planet.
Do you think, Martin, this idea of infinite resources is a real one? Because it does seem that the capitalist system does demand growth almost all the time, doesn't it? It's asking for growth year after year after year.
Yes, and one of the green critiques of that says, well, we must get rid of economic growth. I think that's wrong. What you need to have is economic change. So you're constantly improving your economy, making it more efficient and better managed. But you don't actually want to increase your throughput of resources. We've got to actually make what we've got go a lot further. And that, you know, that requires a technological revolution, doesn't it?
Well, I do recommend people to check this out on YouTube and places like that. This film is called Collapse, and it's by Mike Rupert, R-U-P-P-E-R-T.
Can I just plug Mike Rupert's website, copvcia.com, because, of course, he first came to prominence by uncovering the role of the CIA in major drug dealing inside the United States, and that's why he was forced out of the Los Angeles Police Department.
And there's another one, I think he did a blog for a long, long time called From the Wilderness, didn't he?
He did, yeah. And there's a fantastic thing on the internet of him talking at South Central Los Angeles High School with John Deutsch, who was the deputy director of the CIA, with a howling mob of black parents, basically accusing the CIA of peddling drugs in their community. And
he said he got shot at, didn't he? He was the CIA attempted to recruit him as a drug policeman, and then he got shot at afterwards for speaking out about it.
Yeah, I mean, we've got some serious problems with criminality at the top in the United States of America.
Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next, the Sky News at 7. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM 93.2, where, via our wonderful Barton Hill transmitter, we review the week's news and discuss some of the big stories in Bristol, Britain and around the world. If you want a story discussed, have questions about this evening's programme, or would like to suggest a topic or guest for a future show, please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Conservative Councillor for Brislington East and Chair of Bristol North and West Planning Committee, Barbara Lewis, and our resident Old Labour pundit and Oxford economist, Martin Summers, and of course also to Marina Morris for the Ashton Gate Vox Pop and Report on Ukraine. Next week at 5 on Friday Drive Time, Lib Dem Councillor and Cabinet Member for Environment and Community Safety, Gary Hopkins, will be here to help dissect the news. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all previous Friday Drive Times, including my special report on mobile masts and wireless safety. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.